More inspectors have left the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant as fighting continues around the site.
Geolocated footage from September 2 and 3 show that Russian forces firing MLRS rounds from positions on the ground of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant.
Plus, Russia has revoked the license of a newspaper that's been highly critical of the Kremlin.
The newspaper's editor-in-chief, Dmitry Muratov, calls the move political and not having the slightest legal basis, and promises to contest it.
And later in the program, how everyday travelers are bringing aid to those who need it. Today is Monday, September 5th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. A Russian missile struck a residential area in southwestern Kharkiv on Sunday evening, injuring two civilians. A spokesperson for the local prosecutor's office told reporters the missile exploded between a multi-story apartment and detached houses. Some of the single houses were severely damaged in the aftermath, with the missile pieces shattering windows and doors. Local authorities did not report any deaths. More members of the International Atomic Energy Agency's mission have left the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, which is located in southern Ukraine. According to Russian and Ukrainian authorities, two members of the team are remaining on site. The IAEA is scheduled to brief the United Nations Security Council on Tuesday about their findings. Anna Chernikova now joins us from Kyiv to share the latest.
Steve, you're absolutely correct. Only two representatives of the International Atomic Energy Agency inspection remain at the nuclear power plant. And it seems, and at least according to the reports, they will stay there on a permanent basis. But again, we will see. It's not finally confirmed yet. But today, just a couple of hours ago, we have additional information that as a result of a fire that occurred due to the shelling by the Russian forces, the last power transmission line connecting to the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant with the energy system of Ukraine was disconnected. This was reported by the Energoatom, and also additional shellings were active during the weekend, quite heavy shellings around this territory. And due to today's fire caused by the shelling, the power line Ferosplavna, which was the last line which was connected to the energy system of Ukraine, was disconnected. Now what we know that the network power unit number 6, which currently supplies a nuclear power plant own needs, for the moment, this is it. So for the moment, the Ukrainian energy system do not receive any energy from the plant. The Energoatom emphasized that during the last 3 days, Russian forces have continued intensive shelling. And this was also confirmed by the Institute for the Study of War. In their latest report, they mentioned that geolocated footage from September 2 and 3 show that Russian forces firing MLRS rounds from positions on the ground of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant within 1 kilometer of a nuclear reactor. And they say that latest footage of Russian forces operating MLRS systems at the power plant reaffirms their prior assessment that Russian forces have militarized the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant.
Thanks for the update, Anna. Now, in addition to the fighting that's taking place around Zaporizhzhia, there's also the counteroffensive that was launched by Ukraine in the southern area. What more have we learned about the Ukrainian forces that are seeking to retake territory that's previously been occupied by Russian forces?
Ukrainian officials, military officials reported and confirmed a certain success by the Ukrainian forces over the weekend. We know that Ukrainians continue to destroy Russian supply routes, ammunition depot, and military equipment. Mainly, they are successful with this with the use of HIMARS and aviation. We know also that over the weekend, more than 700 Russian soldiers were killed. This is according to the report by the General Staff of Ukraine. Also, Ukrainian officials, as well as report by the Institute for the Study of War confirm the following information, that actually Ukrainian counteroffensive actions are making verifiable progress in the south and in the east. And if we talk about the south of Ukraine, it's Kherson region. Also, Ukrainian military announced yesterday that the village of Vysokopilla was liberated, and Ukrainian flag is now back to this region. We also have today we had footages from this village, and we saw people who actually were welcoming Ukrainian soldiers, and basically we can see Ukrainian army inside of the village. Also, if we talk about Kherson region, it was reported by the so-called head of Kherson region appointed by the Russian forces, who is now responsible for all Russian activities on the ground in Kherson region. He announced that the so-called referendum will be put on hold. So Russian forces took a break basically from preparation to hold the referendum on accession of the Kherson region to Russia. And Kirill Stremousov, who is this so-called head of Kherson region by the Russian forces, said that this is due to the counter-offensive actions by the Ukrainian armed forces. So Institute for the Study of War in their report also mentioned this and also confirms this information.
Anna Chernikova reports for us from Kyiv, Ukraine. Anna, thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve.
As Liz Truss won the ruling Conservative Party's leadership contest on Monday, she will become Britain's new prime minister. People in Kyiv were hoping that she will continue supporting Ukraine. Sergei Odnorol, a 67-year-old resident from Bucha, told Reuters News that while he was sad to see Britain's previous prime minister Boris Johnson leave office, he felt that Truss would continue to support Ukraine and facilitate its victory. European gas prices rocketed as much as 30% higher on Monday after Russia said that one of its main gas supply pipelines to Europe would stay shut indefinitely, stoking renewed fears about shortages and gas rationing in the European Union this winter. The Nord Stream pipeline, which runs under the Baltic Sea to Germany, historically supplied about a third of the gas Russia exported to Europe, but it was already running at just 20% of capacity before flows were halted last week for maintenance. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said on a phone call with reporters that problems with the gas supply arose because of sanctions imposed on Russia and its companies. Ukrainian Prime Minister Denis Shmyhal urged the European Union on Monday to fulfill its financial and military aid commitments and maintain its support for Kyiv more than 6 months after Russia's invasion. European Parliament President Roberta Metsola spoke to Reuters News following their meeting.
From a Parliament perspective, we made our commitment to do everything we can in the most efficient way possible, as we have since the beginning of this war, in order to do what we need to do for the answers to be given, whether from a practical point of view, whether in terms of political support in the path of Ukraine towards the European Union. But now we have to take it further. There are still military commitments that need to be made, and there's still the support that needs to continue to be unwavering. The risk is that people in Europe forget that there's a war. The risk is that we look away. The risk is that millions of Ukrainians feel like they have no choice but to remain either internally displaced or be outside of Ukraine.
Metsola said that the discussion with Shmyhal focused on whether sanctions against Russia were working, whether they should extend to the digital economy, the continued activities of some EU companies in Russia, and whether to allow Russian tourists into the bloc. Russia has also revoked the media license of a top independent newspaper. From the Associated Press, Charles Deledesma reports.
A court in Moscow has upheld a motion to revoke Novaya Gazeta's license, the latest move in a months-long crackdown on independent media, opposition activists and human rights groups. The newspaper has for years been critical of the Kremlin. The ruling comes amid Russia's grinding military campaign in Ukraine and the Kremlin's efforts to silence critics of what it calls its special military operation. The newspaper's editor-in-chief, Dmitry Muratov, calls the move political and not having the slightest legal legal basis and promises to contest it. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Be sure to visit voanews.com/flashpoint for additional updates throughout the day. Russia has made claims that support for Ukraine has waned in the United Nations since the war began in February. Polygraph.info fact-checks that claim.
On August 26th, the Russian embassy in Turkey tweeted that support for Ukraine had plummeted at the United Nations. The claim came after a UN Security Council meeting 2 days earlier on the six-month anniversary of Russia's all-out war on Ukraine. On March 2, 2022, 141 countries voted in favor of the UN's draft resolution on Ukraine. Kiev's anti-Russian statement at the UN on August 25, 2022, was supported by only 54 out of 193 states. That is false. In fact, on March 2nd, 141 states in the 193-member UN General Assembly voted for a resolution condemning Russia's attack. Then, on August 24th, 57 UN members, plus the European Union, issued a new statement demanding that Russia halt fighting and withdraw. There was no UN meeting about Ukraine on August 25th. Moreover, at the August 24th meeting, Russia's UN ambassador, Vasily Nebenzia, contradicted the embassy. Rather than waning support, Nebenzia noted the unfailing support of Western delegations for any actions of the Kiev regime. What else happened at the UN on August 24th? Russia lost a vote to prevent Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky from delivering a video speech to the Security Council. Only Russia voted against the speech, while China abstained.
Polygraph.info is a fact-checking website that's produced by the Voice of America. The website serves as a resource for verifying the ever-increasing volume of disinformation and misinformation that's being distributed and shared globally. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Thousands of Russians paid their final respects to Mikhail Gorbachev, the last leader of the Soviet Union, on Saturday. Reuters' Louisa Knox has more.
The last Soviet leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, was laid to rest on Saturday. Gorbachev, who presided over the Soviet Union from 1985 until its collapse in 1991, died on Tuesday, aged 91. Much like the funerals of previous Soviet leaders, Gorbachev's body lay in state in Moscow's Grand Hall of Columns. But, unlike his predecessors, Gorbachev was denied a full state funeral. And Russian President Vladimir Putin was noticeably absent. He briefly paid his respects on Thursday at the hospital where Gorbachev died, but said his busy Kremlin schedule prevented him from attending Saturday's service. Putin's no-show is seen by some as a calculated snub by the former KGB officer who has rolled back many of Gorbachev's reforms. Putin has called the breakup of the Soviet Union the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. Also absent were many Western heads of state and government, who normally would have attended, kept away by the chasm in relations between Moscow and the West following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. One European leader who did attend was Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán, who is seen placing flowers by Gorbachev's coffin. Orbán is one of the few European leaders to have good relations with Putin. Gorbachev's legacy still divides opinion inside and outside of Russia. Nevertheless, thousands of Russians of all ages lined up to pay their respects.
I think that this person deserved a real people's farewell ceremony. He is a historic person, no matter how some feel about him. He did a lot. I think he did more good, but some think that he did more bad.
Best known in the West for helping end the Cold War and reducing his country's nuclear stockpile, Gorbachev unwittingly presided over the Soviet Union's demise. His final resting place is in Moscow's Novodevichy Cemetery, where he will be buried alongside his wife, Raisa, who died 23 years ago.
Louisa Knox of Reuters News. Ukraine Air Rescue is an aid organization that flies aid into Poland and its vicinity, using small private aircraft to transport medical supplies and other materials in need. More than $200,000 in medical supplies have been donated and flown in. But some of that precious cargo needs to be refrigerated to ensure it doesn't spoil. That's where Patrick Sherwin comes in. He's the CEO of GoSun, a company that's donating solar-powered refrigeration units. Sherwin began our conversation by explaining why he got involved with the project.
Yeah, we were contacted by a volunteer who is helping with the Ukraine air relief to bring, in this case, critical medicines to families on the ground in Poland who have been displaced by the war. And they simply did not have a good, clean method for refrigerating critical medicines. And since we build portable coolers that have total temperature control, we were a perfect fit. Within 2 days of the phone call, the cooler had been picked up, tossed on various airplanes, largely flown by private retired pilots, and brought across the world full of medicine. I think there was like the first couple of units had like over $100,000 of medicine in them, and brought directly to patients on the ground, saving lives.
So what does it mean for you to be involved with a project like this?
Oh, it's an absolute dream come true. I've spent my career trying to figure out how to get solar power down to like a consumable product to help people really meet their needs. I got into solar a couple decades ago when it was really kind of off grid and everything you did was very essential. You know, people wouldn't have lights or water if you didn't install a solar system in these remote environments. And I've kind of adapted that original, you know, I mean, the solar was originally conceived largely for the space station, you know, to provide power where there is none. And the industry has changed a lot, and it's much more grid interactive, or, you know, kind of financially motivated. And what I've done is really step off of that and try to turn it into a more maintain that consumer, you know, portable power for people modality. And we've broken out several, you know, appliances to meet essential needs and help people build resilience. And so to be involved in disaster relief efforts is so fulfilling and validating that the concept that we're working out there to save lives or really help people during moments of trouble and suffering there's nothing I'd rather be doing.
So how exactly does your product work? Because as you mentioned, you were contacted to provide the solution to provide a container to transport medicine, which in many cases needs to be kept at a very particular temperature to avoid it spoiling, to make sure it's viable once it gets to the ultimate destination. So how exactly does this solar-powered energy work to cool a container that's mobile?
Right. And how is it that you can rely on solar? exactly. Cooler might not be the exact right word for this. It's really a portable refrigerator. So we found brushless DC compressors that use a fraction of the energy of the small portable refrigerators of the past. And they run on 12 volt. So 12 volt happens to be the most common available source of electricity in the world. It's in every car, truck, boat, and in this case, airplane. In addition to that, the refrigerator that we build, they come with integrated lithium ion batteries that also provide 12 volt. And so essentially being able to run on a versatile pallet of power, if you're running the airplane, there's inevitably a 12 volt port you can plug in, and then when the airplane's not providing power, you can plug it into the existing integrated 12 volt battery that it comes with. And then on the ground, once brought into a facility, you can of course plug it into regular, you know, grid power. In addition to all of that, the uniqueness of who we are as GoSun, we have solar that's a flexible folding panel that can live on the cooler, and that can also power it basically directly, because it can provide essentially 12 volt, or it can go into the onboard battery to recharge the battery during the day so that you can keep the cooler running through the night.
Speaking to me from Cincinnati, Ohio, is Patrick Sherwin, the CEO of GoSun. Patrick, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Steve. It's a real pleasure and a real honor to speak with you.
And on that note of aid being flown in to help those affected by the war, travelers heading from the United States to Europe this summer can also help transport relief supplies to Ukraine. Anna Rice narrates that story to round us out.
It's busy here at the San Francisco International Airport. Ivan Hyde is here today, but he's not traveling. He's supporting Ukraine in its fight against Russia.
We're just going to unload all the suitcases.
Hyde's job with the organization Flying Aid is to coordinate the effort to get private travelers to transport essential supplies from the United States to Ukraine.
I thought, what if one passenger, instead of taking three bags with him or her, would take 10 or 20? We would be able to send the aid Ukrainian fighters need so much.
Hyde's friends Andriy Gubienko and Maxim Pavlishin loved the idea. That's how Flying Aid was born. If anyone is willing to pass along a few bags of humanitarian aid, medical supplies or protective gear to Ukraine, they know to go to Hyde. On their end, Hyde and his friends look for passengers traveling from San Francisco to Europe and then make arrangements. Arsen Kostienko is flying to Warsaw, Poland. He gladly agreed to help.
I am doing this to feel useful. It's hard to feel useful if all you do is transfer money. So my trip now feels very important to me.
Volunteers have thought out the entire process, from collecting suitcases and bags, that's Pavlishin's job, to packing them with supplies.
We collect empty suitcases in my garage. At one point, I had 83 empty suitcases. Now it's about 20 or 30. How do we do it? We ask friends and acquaintances. We ask around at work if people have suitcases and bags they don't need.
Hubienko personally inspects the cargo before it gets sent away to make sure all the supplies are in place. Another important detail is the agreement with airlines. Not all airlines are okay with so much extra luggage on board. Yeroma Kuzishin of Hromada, a nonprofit helping raise funds for areas of Ukraine most affected by war, helps passengers deal with the airlines.
Sometimes we get large discounts. At times we're allowed to take all those bags for free. The majority realize the scale of the war and try to help.
In Warsaw, one Flying Aid volunteer receives the suitcases of supplies. Then he sends everything to Lviv, where another volunteer distributes aid throughout Ukraine. For Kristina Shevchenko in San Francisco, California, NRI's VOA News.
And that'll do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with the latest developments in Ukraine and news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day by pointing a web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device to voanews.com. You can also get additional updates throughout the day by following us on social media. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire team here at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.